Radio, and it's a pleasure to be able to express some of the thoughts that this guy who's done amazing homework on me just asked me to do.
Hey, everybody. This is Adam Shartoff, your host of Film Wax Radio. It's Tuesday, September 3rd, 2019, and this is episode 572 of the podcast. A special episode, if you will. Don't normally drop on Tuesdays, but I wanted to put up this episode as quickly as I was able to. It is a returning friend of the podcast, the author, film historian, Joseph McBride, who has a relatively new book, a biography, a metabiography. I'm not really sure how to describe it perfectly, but let me tell you what it's about. Back in 1992, Simon & Schuster published a biography of Joseph McBride's called Frank Capra, The Catastrophe of Success, to great acclaim. It was a major success, this biography. But the story behind its publishing is worthy of a book in of itself. And guess what? That is what Joseph McBride's new book is about. It's about the dramatic story about the road, the journey, an often painful journey that McBride was on in order to get that book published way back then. In fact, you can go back, I think, over like 10 years where he first was supposed to get the book published by Random House. He had pitched this idea of doing a quintessential biography. Now, Capra himself had written an autobiography or a memoir some years earlier called The Name Above the Title, an autobiography, which, you know, everybody loved and was praised at the time it was published, which I think was back in 1971, and McBride himself enjoyed that book. And then as McBride absorbed the book and as he followed up afterwards and got approved by Random House to publish his own biography, he started seeing strange and contradictory information in his research, things that were very unsettling, and that ultimately confirmed for McBride that Capra's autobiography was a work of fiction, essentially. That it was a revisionist look at his own life, a fairy tale version. The most disturbing thing that McBride found out, and he found out this information, by the way, because he was given access by the Wesleyan University archives. The Frank Capra archives are located at Wesleyan University. They gave him access, specifically Janine Bassinger, who oversaw this archive, gave McBride access. And then McBride started finding out unsavory things and contradictions. And at that point, once Bassinger got wind of it, she made life miserable and almost impossible for McBride to get this information out, and she colluded with Random House editor Robert Gottlieb, who was working with McBride, to sabotage McBride's efforts. It took him a pitched legal battle. It took years and years, finally, to get the book back legally and to bring it to another publishing house. And Simon & Schuster, again, ended up publishing this book. So this new book by McBride, which again is called Frankly, Unmasking Frank Capra, is the story of what I told you about, but in great detail. And it goes into the very personal life of McBride himself. And I found it to be such a compelling read. I read it really quickly. And it's a fairly, you know, it's a big book, as McBride is wont to write. But it is, for any fan of Capra, essential reading. And guess what? We have the man here to talk about the book. And I think I was about to tell you the biggest buried secret, which was like, you know, the p- Pandora's box, in a sense, and that was that Capra named names during the Hollywood Red Scare and tried to bury that. He was collaborating witness, named names. And what's kind of more disturbing, if possible, is that a number of the people he named were his screenwriters that he worked with on such films as Mr. Smith Goes to Washington or It's a Wonderful Life. Go figure. All right. Here it is now. This is my conversation with film historian, author, friend of the podcast, Joseph McBride, here on FilmWax Radio. It's a pleasure. Joe, I didn't know what to expect when I got my copy of Frankly. thank you for sending that. I guess originally I just thought naively this was a biography of Capra, but of course the whole point is actually you wrote that book a long time ago. This book, Frankly, Unmasking Frank Capra, is, well, one thing that it is an experience of writing, of your experience writing the biography about Capra, warts and all.
Yeah.
And how a publisher and what would you call, I guess, the archivists and, perhaps, to some degree, family members to sabotage your efforts in telling the whole story about Frank Capra, as I said, warts and all. So this book is about that experience that you had years ago, and you really just let everything fly. I mean, you did not hold back. On another level, this book is about writing authorized versus, or I should say, unauthorized biographies versus authorized biographies. And on another level, this is a memoir. It was brilliant. It was such a nice opportunity to have a window into the inner workings of Joseph McBride. Yeah.
Yeah. What it takes to write a biography of a major American figure. How difficult it can be, and the pitfalls, and I also see it as, I mean, it is primarily a memoir and a book about the making of a book, which is sort of unusual, but I see it as volume two of my Capra biography, too, because it tells his story from a different angle, in a sense, and there's a lot of fresh information about him in there, some of which, you know, I collected when I was writing my book and didn't put in the book for one reason or another, and then some things that I've learned since then. So it's kind of volume two, but suspenseful story. I mean, you know, that has a happy ending and the book will come out, but I think when you read it, you kind of worry about it. Will this ever come out?
Yeah, there's something of a, I guess, suspense thriller side to it. I mean, there really seems to be a conspiracy here. I mean, this was a conspiracy.
Yeah, people working together to do something wrong. That's what a conspiracy is, yeah. It was a harrowing experience, although, I'm very proud of the first book. It was called Frank Capra, The Catastrophe of Success. It came out in 1992, and I started working on it in 1984. And it really took about 3 years to write and about 4 years or so to fight the legal battle to get it out. And so I write about both, and I try to convey, you know, how I discovered some of the revelations about Capra, because this, as one reviewer said, there's a surprise on every page of that book. Capra's life, people thought they knew it because he wrote an autobiography that was very popular, The Name Above the Title, in 1971. And he's been a celebrity since the 1930s, and I co-wrote a TV special on him, the American Film Institute Life Achievement Award show for Frank Capra with George Stevens Jr.
Right, I remember that. I remember this. So you that started it. You wrote the AFI special, right?
Yeah. That was a great experience. I had, actually, it was sort of a mixed bag, that experience. I wrote five of those AFI shows, which collectively were the best experiences I had as a screenwriter. I wrote Jimmy Stewart, Frank Capra, Fred Astaire, John Huston, Lillian Gish.
Lillian Gish, right.
Yeah, and they were wonderful because they allowed me to work with all these great legendary actors and directors and other people from the golden era of Hollywood who, a screenwriter of my age, I was in my 30s at the time, would never have worked with otherwise. And so that was wonderful, and I saw it as a kind of film history for the masses. They were on CBS, and it was popular, and you couldn't get too highbrow, but you know, I tried to convey some thoughtful commentary on the films and mm-hmm. analyze the work of the honoree, and also write the speeches with the stars and as much as possible. Occasionally, somebody would write his or her own speech. That didn't happen very often, but mm-hmm. I would try to work with them and make it sound like them. And sometimes they would have a lot to say, and sometimes they didn't have much to say, and I would just, you know, put a speech in their mouth that they approved of, like Betty Davis on our Capra show. She really didn't get along with Capra when she worked with him on Pocketful of Miracles, and we said, "Do you have anything to say about him?" And she said, "No, just write me something." And I wrote something, and she, our producer, read it to her over the phone, and she said, "Perfect," you know, which was a nice pleasure for me. And then she came in on the rehearsal night, and she said, "Do you mind if I change a few words here and there?" And I said, "Oh, geez, you're Betty Davis, of course, you know." It was nice of her to ask, but if she had tried to say something that I thought was not going to work, I would have worked with her.
Right.
So, you know, that usually was good to stimulate their input, and then we would work in the editing room to tighten things up, et cetera. But it was a pleasure. But the Capra show was difficult because, partly because George Stevens Jr., our producer, didn't really like Capra very much, and I suspect it was some holdover from his father, the great director George Stevens' fraught relationship with Capra. They were partners in Liberty Films.
They were partners for a while.
Yeah, William Wyler and Capra and Sam Briskin, and they had a unpleasant ending to that because Capra decided to sell the company and George Stevens wanted to continue. But they also politically were at odds. Stevens was a liberal, Capra was a conservative, and one of the big revelations in my book is that Capra was an informer in the blacklist period. He was under suspicion by the government of communist sympathies or disloyalty, which is
because he had collaborated with a number of screenwriters.
Right.
That ended up being accused of being communists, and some of them were indeed communists. But because he worked with them, that he was then brought in front of. He wasn't brought in front of
HUAC. No, he never testified publicly. That was some people have said that, but it's not true. There were a number of charges against him. What it was, he was working for a Defense Department think tank called Project Vista, with Caltech, which was his alma mater, and they were doing this for the, they were planning World War III strategy, basically, if World War III broke out in Europe, and Capra was the head of psychological warfare, and he was writing memoranda about how to use motion pictures and other propaganda methods to counteract the Soviets, and this was an extension of his work in World War II when he did the Why We Fight propaganda series for the Army. But this was very clandestine, Project Vista, and this was 1951, during the height of the blacklist McCarthy period. And even though McCarthy was not involved in the Hollywood blacklist, that he was running rampant around that time. And so Capra was accused of a number of disloyal actions, some of which were absurd, such as collaborating with the Soviets in World War II, you know, getting propaganda material from them. Well, of course, they were our allies, you know. And he made the Battle of Russia. But when you made a film, this happened to other people in the film business, if you made a film that was supportive of the Soviet Union in World War II, you were looked on with suspicion after the war, which is ridiculous because they were our allies. And
of course.
But the situation changed so drastically. But most of the charges were somewhat frivolous or silly. The one about collaborating with screenwriters and other people who were suspected to be communists was grounded in reality, although it's a classic case of guilt by association, which was
of course, right.
A big part of McCarthyism and the blacklist, that just because you work with somebody doesn't mean you're a traitor. And it was not illegal to be a communist.
Right.
You know, it's protected under the First Amendment, but that became a big legal issue when some of the people were called to testify. They took the First Amendment or the Fifth Amendment. But Capra, I tallied up, he worked with about 20 to 25 people who were screenwriters who were in one shape or form or another in trouble with the blacklist. Some were gray-listed, which is this kind of Kafkaesque state in which they were not sure if they were blacklisted or not. One of the things about the blacklist that was so Orwellian or Kafkaesque was they denied it really existed because it was illegal to blacklist people. So James Burns, who was Secretary of State at one time, was hired as their legal guy who said, don't admit that there is a blacklist because it's illegal. So it was maddening for people who were on this. They couldn't get work, but they couldn't be told you're on the blacklist and there is no way to clear themselves, except they had certain clearance groups that sprang up where they sometimes took bribes or they did this for money or they would have these private groups that worked with the studios to clear people, or you could write a letter sometimes to a studio and disavow your previous connections. But often you had to testify before the House Committee on Un-American Activities publicly, and if you were under real suspicion, you had to inform on your colleagues to save yourself or else be blacklisted.
So like two of the screenwriters, for instance, that he collaborated with frequently were Robert Riskin and Sidney Buckman, right?
Yeah, Riskin was a liberal anti-communist. He was never under suspicion. Buckman was a Communist Party member. He admitted that. He was blacklisted, and he was a communist when he worked on Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, which is a fascinating irony. It's one of the greatest American patriotic films, and I once asked a friend of Buckman's, I said, you know, how is a communist writing such a great patriotic film? And he said, well, he was an American communist. I love that line. The Communist Party in America in that period was supporting the Popular Front, which was the liberals and the communists were working together against fascism. Mm-hmm. And so the Communist Party's slogan in America was communism is 20th century Americanism. So they were stressing the principles of the founding fathers and the Constitution. They were not stressing other things that would cause people to not want to work with them. But so Mr. Smith is a film that upholds the Constitution very strongly and freedom of speech, freedom of the press,
right,
et cetera. So it's no real contradiction that he wrote that great film. But Capra informed on him when he was under suspicion by this. The Defense Department had a personnel security board, Army, Navy, Air Force personnel security board, issued these charges. They withheld his security clearance, so he couldn't get classified information. And this threw him into a complete uproar because he was so patriotic. I mean, he was an immigrant who came from Sicily, and he loved America, and he served the country in World War II, and it's a terrible tragedy that he was accused of disloyalty, but he had worked with a lot of left-wing writers, and he also worked with conservatives and liberals. And mm-hmm. part of one of his associates, Chet Stitch, who was his secretary, right-hand man for a long time, observed that one of Capra's great strengths as a filmmaker was that he worked with a wide range of people, and he kind of drew from different people and synthesized their work. He was the boss, and what went into the film was what he approved of, but he depended a lot on the writers, and so he was big enough to, you know, to work with people who he didn't agree with politically, on some issues, and he and Buckman had some friction during the writing of Mr. Smith over what the film meant, and Buckman felt Capra didn't actually understand or approve of what the film said, and that's one of the ironies I explore in my book, is that, you know, Capra's seen as a kind of liberal New Deal spokesman as a director, but he hated the New Deal, and he hated Franklin D. Roosevelt, never voted for him, he was a Republican all his life, and he didn't agree with necessarily the what he was saying in his own movies. And
do you get a sense? For one thing, Capra comes across like just as an not really that politicized a person.
Well, and yes, maybe and no.
Not so deep.
He wasn't very deep. Yeah, I mean, part of his problem, I think, was he saw his means of success in America as education, and he went to what became Caltech. It was called Troop Institute of Technology at the time. It was an engineering school, and he got remarkable for a son of immigrants to go to high school, let alone college in those days. So he really worked at it, and he got a college degree, and he wanted to be a chemical engineer, and that didn't pan out. His grades weren't good enough, but he said he discovered poetry at Caltech and literature. But he didn't get a very good education in terms of history, sociology, things of that sort. And he got some good education in English from a couple of good teachers there. But he was not prepared for when he became a celebrity in the 30s with It Happened One Night. What happens is people come to you and they want you to make statements about politics and the world situation. And, you know, you see this with other directors, like Spielberg does this, and he handles it better than Capra did, and Capra was not prepared for that. He wasn't sophisticated politically, and his views were kind of simple-minded right-wing views, and yet his films were sort of New Deal parables to some extent, because Riskin had a lot of influence on the themes of the film, as did Joe Swerling, who's another liberal writer, and so Capra was kind of in a bind. He was had to defend films that he didn't totally believe in. And why he made these films is kind of an interesting dilemma. And I think part of it was commercial calculation. I found an interview with him in 1932 where he said somebody's going to make a big hit from the Depression if they can capture the mood of the people. You know, he was savvy enough to know that the people wanted a certain kind of film and he would give it to them. And there was part of Capra that still could identify with being poor and struggling and the working man, and he had risen far above that, and he became very wealthy, and he identified with the wealthy part of our country and wanted to be like them, and he looked down on people who didn't make it as he did, and so he was quite critical of people who he thought weren't able to, you know, succeed like he did, and he was also a racist, a bigoted person, and so he was a bundle of contradictions. And so when these left-wing writers were writing his films, it got him in trouble because he was known as a social critic in the 30s, which he pretty much was. Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, You Can't Take It With You, Mr. Smith, Meet John Doe, 1941. So after the war, these things were held as under suspicion. There was this ironic phrase or Orwellian phrase, premature anti-fascist, for people who were anti-fascist too early, you know. And he kind of fit that bill, so he had to apologize for it, he thought. But he didn't have the guts to just say, well, you know, this is what I believed in, and the films were important, and my views may have changed or whatever. He didn't level with the public very much. I found a few public statements he made, but he kept it under wraps. So a lot of this story, most of the story was totally unknown when I did my book. And I found a document he wrote of more than 200 pages to the security board in which he tried to justify himself and he tried to explain his positions and explain that he was a Republican, Catholic, anti-communist, hated the communists. And then he informed on seven people in the document, including the screenwriters Michael Wilson and Sidney Buckman and Ian McClellan Hunter and Hugo Butler and three other people. And so this to me was a huge revelation and somewhat of a shock because I was a Capra admirer. You know, I always loved his films.
Sure.
And you know, like a lot of people, I kind of, you know, I thought he must have been a liberal New Dealer kind of guy. And then I found out he wasn't. And so I started getting the sense of this when I started working on that show.
Is this before 1971 or when you started to have suspicions, or had you already read his memoir, his autobiography?
I read his memoir in 71, and like most people, thought it was very beguiling, and it's a very entertaining book, and it's a feisty book about a guy who fights his way up to the top. And I had some kind of feelings that something wasn't quite right, because there was this section in the book set in early 52 where he goes to India to a festival, and he's very belligerently anti-communist, and he has a diary, and he's throwing in all these very strident, kind of simple-minded views on communism. And I thought, wow, this is sort of jarring. What happened here? I had a sense that there was something that went on during that period that changed him and or made him behave oddly. And so when I did the AFI show, I went to Wesleyan University in Connecticut, where they had his papers, and they hadn't been open to the public yet. But the archivist, Janine Basinger, who's a well-known film scholar who has connections with the AFI, offered to help us, so I went there. And
this was the first time?
Yeah, the first time I'd been there was in 81, late 81. The show was in 82. And so I went through the papers for several days, and she opened up the papers to me. And the first thing I did was I said, could I see the box for 51, 52? And because I had the sense that there was something there that would be revealing. And sure enough, within about 30 minutes, I had the story. I found that document, the security board file, where he informed on people. And that was the basic big revelation. Of course, it took years to provide context and to analyze the whole thing. And I found in the papers later, when I went back, there were many letters and memoranda and other things related to that. And then in his autobiography, a lot had been cut out of it that was more candid, that his editor persuaded him to cut because he wrote a lot about politics, and it didn't make him look very good. And so,
all right, but let me just be sure. Yeah. Let me just make sure I understand. So you went to Wesleyan, to the archive, Frank Capra archives, initially before the your research for the AFI special, or because it was around that time. And you just wanted to clarify some things that didn't make sense to you. Was this before you decided to write the definitive biography?
Yeah, happened, I'd done the AFI show for James Stewart in 1980 and got to know Capra. I'd met Capra in 1975. I should tell this little story because it's revealing.
Sure.
When I say that I was starting to figure out that Capra was not quite the man he purported to be, I had lunch with him. First time I met him, I went to Palm Springs and I was interviewing him for Variety. And he was very charming, very beguiling guy. He took me to lunch at a country club, and he was going on about how he hated bankers and rich people. He was doing his whole Frank Capra rap, kind of. And a guy came over to the table, wearing a sport coat and tie, and had these photographs of Capra with playing golf with President Ford. And he said, here, Frank, these pictures, and he put them on the table, and Capra was saying, oh, my God, this is great, you know. There's a picture of President Ford holding the pin for Capra while he putted, which I thought was sort of the ultimate immigrant fantasy. And he was saying, oh, Jerry Ford, such a great guy, you know, and wonderful pictures. And the guy said, I'll send you copies this week. And anyway, so when the guy left the table and Capra turned back to me and he said, where was I? He said, oh, yeah, I was telling you how I hate bankers and rich people. And that was very revealing to me because he suddenly did a 180-degree turn to his public image as this kind of, you know, anti-establishment liberal, which he was not. And he had just shown his great love for adulation by the establishment. And Ford admired his work. And so Capra was thrilled that he was accepted by the American establishment. So I thought there's a schism here. This is not the man he purports to be. And I kind of made a mental note, find out more. So I had my suspicions. So when I went to Wesleyan, this was the second year. I did the Fred Astaire show, and then the Capra show came along. Capra was on the Jimmy Stewart show, so I got a chance to meet him again. And so when I went to Wesleyan, it was to research the Capra show, but I was curious. I don't think I was thinking, well, I'm going to do a biography. But I think when I found the security board file and other things and realized what a great collection this was, I began thinking there's a biography here, there's a great story that hasn't been told by the media, you know?
Yeah. So that explains. So Jeanine, why would she have any concern?
Well, I don't think she had read the papers, for one thing. She had persuaded Capra to donate his papers to the university. That's kind of a story in itself. I go into that. He had earmarked them for another school, but she got them, and she knew him. But I don't think she had gone through them. They hadn't been cataloged, so I was finding out things that she didn't know. But foolishly, I said to her, "Gee, you know, I found out this interesting thing. He informed on people during the blacklist period."
That was your biggest misstep, even though how would you possibly predict it was a misstep?
Yeah, I go into the book, I chastise myself for from time to time for things that proved to be unfortunate, naive steps. I thought as a fellow scholar she would find it interesting, but I hadn't counted on her being Machiavellian, which she was. And she played it blasé, like, okay. And she let me Xerox some materials from the papers, et cetera. Then I did the show, and when I did the show, I got to know Capra quite well because I would go to see him in Palm Springs a lot and had long talks with him, and I took notes, and he and I worked on his acceptance speech together, which was interesting. For example, he said the love of people and the equal importance of each person is the formula upon which I based all my films. And I said to him, "Well, gee, formula doesn't sound too good. How about principle?" He said, "Oh, great, okay, principle, you know." Mm-hmm. And I later realized it was a formula to him, mm-hmm. the love of people.
Right.
He really didn't love people. You know, he loved actors, I'd say that much, but he didn't love most people in general. And,
well, he himself was an actor.
Yeah.
Playing a role.
Yeah.
Right? I mean,
yeah, so that's a good insight. Yeah, he's playing the role of a great humanitarian, and a director is a kind of an actor, as Orson Welles said. And Capra had done a little acting in his youth, etc. He was playing a role throughout his life. He had a dual life. There was the real guy who I discovered, and then there was this fake image that people came to love.
Mm.
And so I later thought, I wish I hadn't improved on him by having him say it's a principle rather than a formula. But anyway, we did the show, and I didn't find it very satisfying because George really didn't seem to like Capra or his films very much, and our editor.
If I went back and I watched his introduction of, introducing and bringing out Frank Capra at that special, it's on YouTube.
Yeah.
And just about everything else is there too. And you would not be able to tell for a moment that George Stevens Jr. did not like Frank Capra. He did a good job of covering that.
Well, that's good. Well, he does a good job. He's very diplomatic. And,
Can't
expect him to like all the honorees equally, but I thought there was a certain animus he had. And, for example, he had never seen It's a Wonderful Life, which was kind of bizarre. And I kept saying, we should show it to you. You got to see this film. And he wouldn't see it. And we showed one scene, which is a great scene where Jimmy Stewart proposes to Donna Reed, which mm-hmm. Capra told me was probably the best scene he ever directed, and George didn't get it. You know, like he didn't get the point of the scene, and we showed it anyway. But it was a struggle, and then Susan Winslow, the editor, didn't really like Capra. She was one of these people who thinks that Capra was too sentimental, et cetera. And so,
wait, this is the editor of the AFI?
Yeah, she was who, I mean, I worked on those shows. I helped pick the clips and everything, but it was kind of a battle with her.
How old were you when you did this?
Well, I would have been about 35, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't as fun as doing the Astaire show, for example, which I think is our best. We had a wonderful time, but we all loved Astaire and his films. I mean, he was a cantankerous guy, but I mean, he was a great artist. And the John Huston show went very well. And the Gish show was a nightmare to do for other reasons because they didn't like Gish either, and I was the only person who liked Gish. But the Capra show... Also,
who didn't like Gish?
George really didn't like the idea of honoring a silent movie actress on national TV, nor did CBS drop the show as a result because the ratings were so low.
Mm.
The idea of doing a 90-year-old silent movie actress on primetime national TV was pretty amazing. I was very proud of that, happy we did that, but It did not go over well.
Commercially speaking, it didn't make sense to those guys. I get that, even though they were wrong.
Yeah, they were wrong. Jean Furstenberg, the head of the AFI at the time, who was a woman, who loved that we were doing it.
Yeah.
So there were women in the AFI, but again, we had an editor who didn't like Gish very much. You know, so I was the only guy. The show was almost a disaster, but I managed to pull it off. But anyway, that was the last thing I did before I retired from screenwriting in 84 to do the Capra book. I began thinking after the Capra show I should do this biography, and but it took me a while to kind of extricate myself psychologically from the film business. And
but you were motivated by what you found out. You wanted to go public and correct the myths that were behind Frank Capra, the name above the title, and autobiography.
Yeah, and part of the problem with the show is you can't really do that on a show celebrating somebody to say, you know, he's an informer and all that. And there were some things I tried to work into the show that, for example, Capra admitted that he sold fake mining stock to people in his youth. And George said, well, we can't say that because people will say, how come this guy's not in jail, you know? Mm-hmm. And Capra wrote in his autobiography when he was a boy, he hated America. And I had that in the little biographical film, and George said, well, we can't do that either. And I said, well, you came to love America, but, you know, it's a certain truths you can't say on these kind of shows, so I was frustrated. So, yeah, I wanted to tell the story, and being an old journalist from 1960 onward, I recognized that I had a great scoop, and he was a great character for a biography because he's psychologically so complex. He's like a Dostoevsky figure, and, you know, I was very excited to do this, and I decided in 84 to write a proposal, and I wrote a really good proposal laying out. I'd done a lot of research, which helps when you're trying to sell a book. I really knew what I was going to do, and when you read the proposal...
You had a plan, right.
Yeah, it pretty much tracks the book. I mean, it's not... You know, I mean, I found out a lot along the way in all the research. I interviewed 175 people, and I spent a year interviewing Capra, who was pretty cooperative, although not always, but... and I found tremendous amount of documentation in other sources as well as at Wesleyan. I went back to Wesleyan and read all the Capra papers for, I guess, 4 months. And then I went to a lot of other archives and got his Army intelligence file. I couldn't get his FBI files until after the book was published. I spent 7 years filing requests to try to get his FBI files, and I finally got them after the book came out. So I did a follow-up in 2000, an appendix for a paperback edition and further discoveries in the FBI files. And I got State Department files, et cetera. But there's a tremendous amount of paperwork on all of his paper trail. And I was keeping my own paper trail. That's what I call the introduction to this book. Lawyers taught me this, that, you know, keep a paper trail if you're involved in some kind of a dispute or controversy. Keep a record of everything. So every phone conversation I had, verbatim notes of what was said, and I took notes on every meeting I had, and I kept all the letters and documents. I had many boxes of documents, and I've been...
That sounds like the best advice you ever got.
Yeah, that was great advice. My brother Mike McBride is a lawyer, and he was the guy who told me that.
Your
that
brother.
Was great.
Yeah.
And he helped me.
I mean, you're having taken, you know, documented everything was you know, ultimately what turned this to your favor.
Yeah.
If you want to call it that. I mean,
yeah, it was a struggle, and, you know, you have to have solid documentation of everything while you're trying to win the battle. It was a very difficult battle.
Nobody else thought to do this. The Janines, you ended up signing with the most prestigious publishing house, right? You ended up signing with Random House. And
Alfred A. Knopf, yeah.
And Knopf, which is...
part of Random House, yeah.
Part of, you know, significant part of Random House. And you were assigned their number one editor.
Yeah, Robert Gottlieb, the great editor. And this is one of the reasons I went with him. I was offered Simon and Schuster, St. Martin's, they were also interested. But Bob Gottlieb, who is a kind of legend in the publishing world, he's edited many important books, Robert Caro's books.
Right. I want to tell you something.
Yeah.
I'm going to see Robert Caro in a couple of weeks.
Good.
He's got a new book, and it actually made me think of you because I think his new book is a personal book about writing, I think. And did you hear about that?
Yeah, I've read the book. It's terrific. Yeah, it's terrific. And some of it has been published before. And when I was doing my book, frankly, Unmasking Frank Capra, I read a lot about Caro because partly because he's always been a Gottlieb writer.
Right.
And so I learned some things about Gottlieb from Caro interviews and articles. But I'm fascinated by his work. I love his book on Robert Moses.
I know, I could tell.
Power Broker.
Of course. Who published the new book?
Caro's new book is with Random House as well.
See, wow, interesting.
It's a collection of his pieces, and he has a couple of new pieces. And some of the stories are familiar if you read his interviews, but they're all fascinating about how he works and how he. I mean, he's a real sleuth, and he was a role model for me. I studied biographers and historians when I did this book, and he was one of the people who meant a lot to me, especially his first volume on Lyndon Johnson. The early years of Johnson's life was really amazingly researched. And I was struck by the fact that he starts that book with about 40 pages. Johnson doesn't even appear. It's about the hill country in Texas and the very tough conditions that people had to survive there, and especially women trying to work on farms and in homes, and how Johnson brought electricity to this area. And it showed the power of the political genius that he had and the good side of Johnson. And then it gets into the dark side of Johnson, and it really deals with the, you know, as Caro said, the light and dark threads are interwoven throughout his four volumes. He's now working on the fifth. But I was struck by the fact that he interviewed a lot of so-called ordinary people. And most film biographies up to that time were pretty poor, frankly. One of the problems was they only interviewed usually about 8 or 10 people, and they were mostly movie stars. They would go to big-name people, and if they were lucky enough to get Cary Grant or somebody to give an interview, that was great. But they didn't interview the unknown people who grew up with the person. And psychologists always tell us that our personalities are formed in our first 7 years, more or less. So I wanted to meet all the people who knew Capra as a boy and went to school with him, and you know, his neighbors and his roommate, his college friends. And so I interviewed about, I think it was 18 people who went to high school with him, 18 people who went to college with him, several from his earlier period. And then I interviewed a lot of his crew members who told me a lot of very concrete, factual things about the way he worked. And those are the guys who aren't interviewed much in books because they want to interview the star.
There's no guide to how to write. You had to figure this out through reading other biographers, but there's no dummies guide to writing biographies.
There are some books. There's one, Leon Adell, who wrote a great 5-volume biography of Henry James, wrote a terrific book called Writing Lives, which is kind of like that guide that you were just mentioning. And I read that when I was planning my Capra book. It's a terrific short book, you know.
My point being, though, that one thing I learned from reading you, because I kind of feel like your book, frankly, I think this is a must-read for anybody considering writing a biography, because for one thing, I learned, in addition to all this information about, of course, Frank and yourself, is I always figured, well, you know, if I'm reading an unauthorized biography, I'm sort of going to probably be reading something that's going to be all secondhand sources, nothing truly verifiable. I'm going to be reading a more maybe tabloidy, lurid type of account. In fact, it's the exact opposite. What you don't want to do, this was really interesting to learn, is that if you're writing in collaboration with your subject and their friends and family and colleagues, is actually then all of a sudden you are co-opted? No, that's not the right word.
That's the right word. That's compromised.
There's a relationship here. You're not only relying on their version, and they have a stake in it, in their version, but Yeah, it's very subjective.
Mm-hmm.
And you are, in a way, how can you not be making a bargain? So it's tricky. So, and also, as an extension of that, you can write an unauthorized biography and have cooperation with people that knew the person.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not beholden on some level to get their ultimate approval and participation.
Yeah, right? That's so, all very well put. And I do think my book is kind of like a, you know, if you're going to write a biography of not just a film director, but anybody, it shows you all the, what the do's and don'ts, you know, the dangers and the mm-hmm. possible good things that happen.
Pitfalls. Yeah,
pitfalls.
And the good things. And the good things, yeah.
Yeah, and it is kind of the worst case scenario. I found, since I've done my book and I did research on other biographies, I wrote a whole final chapter on my thoughts on biographies, and mm-hmm. there are some famous examples of terrible things that happened to other biographers, and more people have come to me. You don't hear about a lot of these stories because people often don't talk about them, and I sat on this story from 1992 onward. Nobody really asked me about it, frankly, but I wasn't feeling in the mood to talk about it until recently. I thought, well, I should get this off my chest. This is an important story, and
it
these
is,
people
and
tried to stop my book, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredible story. It's cinematic, frankly. I mean, but you were in a way, the irony of this is, this is like a Frank Capra movie.
Yeah.
You were the little guy
yeah.
pushing up against, you know, these big institutions like big publishing,
yeah.
Big academia, and, you know,
yes,
you really had no money. You had barely any resources. You had obviously some strong relationships and some good guidance. After a while, you ultimately found a very good lawyer. You found people to advocate for you. But you were essentially the Jimmy Stewart character.
Yeah,
through
yeah
this.
It was like, I was aware of that. It was like a Capra movie, the great
okay.
irony. And then Capra was the bad guy. He was the Edward Arnold character. You know. Yeah, I mean, yeah. He was actually, and to give him his due, he was somewhat cooperative, as I say. He gave me a lot of very revealing interviews, although part of the pattern we established was he would sort of lie about things, and then I would go off and find out the truth from talking to people who knew him, and then I'd come back to him and I'd say, well, this woman who went to high school with you says such and such. For example, he claimed he had a wonderful time in high school, and then, you know, I interviewed like 17 people, and they all either they didn't know him very well, or they said, oh, we all had a great time. And then I finally met a woman who knew him well, who she was the class historian, and she liked him, and she even dated him a little bit. And she said, I wouldn't have gone out with him because he was a nice boy, but he was just a terrible wop, is the way she put it. And I was really
wow.
kind of stunned. I felt angry for Capra. You know, I was...
Yeah.
I often write books out of a feeling of indignation or trying to rectify an injustice, either that's done, you know, Capra committed injustices against other people, but also to history, that history had been maligned and distorted. But here I began to feel more empathy for Capra as an immigrant and poor guy who was looked down on. So I went back to him and I said, and she said also the girls wouldn't go out with him because he looked shabby, et cetera. And so I went back to Capra and I told him this, and he said, yeah, that's what happened. They snubbed me and they were terrible. And then he got, you know, indignant about them, and the truth came out. So that was the pattern. It was like a challenge, and he was interested. Like, I think he enjoyed it because, for example, I interviewed a woman who was on a double date with him in college, and one of his lies was that he never had girlfriends in college because he was working so hard, which was not true. And I found his girlfriend in college. But I found this other lady who went on a double date, and she said Capra was making out in the front seat with some blonde. So I told Capra, and he got kind of irked, and he said, well, she was making out pretty heavily in the back seat, you know. But I think he liked hearing about what people were saying about him. So it was a kind of a cat and mouse thing. But he did help me up to a point, and then he kind of stonewalled me on certain things. You know, I think part of him really felt like confessing, and by giving his papers to the university, including all these damaging documents, I think subconsciously or not, he was confessing, getting it off his chest. And as Andrew Serres pointed out a long time ago, that's the obligatory scene in a Capra film, he said, where the hero gets up and confesses his failures and it's kind of a Christian motif. Confession is good for the soul. But these papers were sitting there, and the archivist didn't really know what was in them until I told her, and then she started sanitizing. When I went back to study the papers, some of the things were not there, and she was quite difficult about it, but I did get through all the papers that I was allowed to see. But she started insinuating herself with Robert Gottlieb. Janine Basinger became friends with him, which I was kind of stunned by because...
And she actually had her own book, some sort of making of, right, of It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah, it's called the It's a Wonderful Life book.
There was a conflict of interest there that Gottlieb... Yeah. Gottlieb comes off as being not very professional, I have to say.
No, I was very disillusioned by him because he was a man of great repute.
Of course.
And
an obvious talent.
Great talent. But he loved the idea of the book. He thought Capra was the most interesting man in the world, is what he told me. And at first he thought, that I was getting all the goods on Capra, and this is terrific. But I warned him in New York. I went to see him when I was at Wesley, and I took a bus to New York, and I said, she's trying to withhold documents, including this particular document, and I'm worried about her. And he said, I think I can handle it. Don't worry about it, and we'll make sure you get the papers. So I was somewhat reassured. But then in January, when I got back home, he called me up and he said, I want to alert you to something we're going to do. We're going to do a book called the It's a Wonderful Life book with Janine Basinger. And right. I was really stunned and shocked. And this, to me, was kind of the turning point where I knew that things were going really badly.
Right.
And I was very upset, but I had to control myself all the way through this book and not lose my temper. And
you had to show incredible restraint.
Yeah. If I had lost my temper or said the wrong thing, they would have reminded me of that forever. And
not only that, but you didn't even lose your temper, but anytime you in any way pushed back at all, you were considered a troublemaker.
Yeah, they tried to paint me as this very difficult troublemaking guy. And Gottlieb at one point said, you know it all, you may know too much, which was, again, a
great
shocking
telling.
Statement for an editor to say. First of all, how did he know that I knew it all, which is interesting. I mean, I did pretty much know it all, but you may know too much. How could How could a biographer know too much?
Right.
I mean, isn't that what a publisher wants, is the inside full truth?
Yeah.
But he became friends with hers and was publishing this book, Drawn from Their Archives, which is a direct competitor
but what
my
was
book,
the,
my book.
What was the advantage of him for him to become friends with her over your supplying Random House or Knopf with a huge bestseller? I mean, why compromise your reputation as an editor, as a publishing legend, etc.? I don't know if ultimately he tarnished his reputation that greatly as far as the general public is concerned, aside from the McBrides. You know, what could possibly be such a big deal about being friends with Janine Basinger over publishing what was ultimately a really wonderfully regarded book, which ended up being published by Simon & Schuster.
Yeah, I had to leave Knopf to get it published. Well, I think there's some mysteries. I don't purport to know all the, what went on in his mind or between them, but I have some pretty strong beliefs. Part of what he told me was, he said, I'm going to feel a little two-faced doing your book and her book. But he said, I did two books on Gloria Vanderbilt. He did her memoir, and there was a book about her.
Yeah.
And he said, I balanced these two. He was very proud of the fact that he could handle Gloria Vanderbilt's autobiography in this other book. And he said, I can do the same with these two books. And I think that's a sign of hubris as an editor that you could...
It's a good...
You're so clever that you can do that.
It's a good description of it, yeah.
Yeah, but I think that he got...
Nixon could be very proud that he was able to get away with as much as he did. What does that mean? Doesn't mean that it's right to do it.
No, and he shouldn't have done it because it interfered with, legally with my rights and my contract, because it's a form of competition. And I had put him on notice that she was thwarting my book. And then Even after that, I mean, every step of the way, she was trying to block me from getting permission to use unpublished material from the papers. At first, she promised me I could quote yes. whatever I wanted.
That was a big part of the book, which I was my most difficult part. That was the most sort of, for me, that was like kind of the most difficult part of your book was the extensive description of all of the legalities around quoting from non-published quotes.
Yeah.
What have you.
It gets Kafkaesque, and I read the trial again because it is similar. She tried, you know, to pretend that she was going to get permission, but she kept moving the goalposts, and it gets, you know, I quoted all these conversations and false statements she made, and she, you know, the game became, let's just keep stalling and stalling and stalling and telling him we'll give permission and we're not going to really do that. I mean, she really never had the intention to do that, I'm sure.
Well, another unfortunate part of the timing that played a big part in their ability, meaning Gottlieb and Basinger, their ability to stall and to screw around with you, was that in that period of time, there were two landmark cases in the publishing world, right, which really worked to your disadvantage, correct? Like
yeah,
with Salinger?
Yeah, before, I just should say, just to
go
complete
ahead.
The
yeah.
picture, that
yes,
not only
do.
Was he tempted to do this book with her, he became very friendly with her. She can be a very warm-seeming, you know, friendly person. She has a lot of fans and followers. She's kind of a grandmotherly,
well,
you know, person that people like. But she's two-faced. But with him, she was very charming. And she's been publishing books with Knopf ever since. That was part of her goal, I think, was to get in not only the It's a Wonderful Life book, but a series of other books. That,
is she still around?
She's still around. She's still publishing books. She's
she
doing
is?
A book on musicals, I guess, with Knopf.
Is she 90 years old or something?
She's in her 80s. She's still yeah. vigorous. She's working still with Wesleyan. She's not the head of the archive right now. She's the, I don't know what they call it, emeritus head of the archive, but she's assistant to the president of the university.
Wow. I hope you send her a signed, an autographed copy of
well,
the book.
I haven't done that, but Gottlieb really became friends with her and started going to movies with her and taking trips with her and
so
stuff. And all.
You know,
it got very unprofessional, yeah. And
he's
course,
still around, but he's retired, but he's still around.
Well, he left Knopf to become editor of The New Yorker, and that didn't work out very well, so he left that. And he's been editing books for Knopf ever since. It's a nice position where he can edit whatever he wants, and he edits Caro and other.
He still edits Caro?
Yeah, I mean, Caro's doing his fifth volume, and Gottlieb will edit that.
Well, I'm going to meet him. I'm going to meet Caro in a couple of weeks. I'm going to confront him. I'm going to ask him about Gottlieb.
I sent Caro a copy of my book. I haven't heard back, but
oh, really?
Yeah,
I'm going to ask him. All right, I'll ask him to. I'm going to suggest he read it. Make sure he reads it. If he hasn't,
I think he will find it very interesting if he hasn't read it. He's probably got his hands full trying to finish Johnson. But
oh, he's got one more volume?
Well, he's got one volume to do, which covers everything from the 64 to the end of Johnson's life, which is a big, you know, his whole presidency and everything. He dealt with some of the presidency in the last volume, but he's got to finish the whole story. It's a huge job, and he's in his 80s, and he talks very frankly about, you know, I just hope I finish it. And, you know, but he's a very hardworking guy, but he
wow.
takes his time. So anyway, Gottlieb became pals with her, and so they colluded to block my book, and it put Gottlieb in a difficult position, to put his company in a difficult position, and I get the sense that they felt compromised by his being compromised, you know, because they had a contract with me, and it got passed over to their legal department after a while, and I had an adversary in their legal department who I dealt with for years, who
right.
was a real stonewalling man named Ellis Levine. And,
but you don't think... I'm sorry, I keep interrupting you, but it doesn't make sense that based on some charisma that Jeanine Basinger has, that Gottlieb would have sold quite made these weird ethical decisions, you know, choices.
Mm.
Do you think there's anything in terms of Capra himself that they felt like they wanted to defend? Do you don't think that really played much of a role?
Well, yeah, I mean, I go into, as I say, I don't claim to know all the story, but I think that the Capra family was the third party in this whole thing, and
that's
even
right.
though Frank Capra I made it clear to him this is unauthorized biography because, as you said, I don't believe in writing those because authorized biographies because you, as Gottlieb himself said to me, there's always a price to be paid. You know, you are a compromise, and I wouldn't do that. So I made clear to Capra that, you know, I'm the boss. I actually said to him, it's one man, one book, because he used to say, one man,
yeah,
one
that
film.
Was, we should have started with that. It's almost like the epitaph for your...
Yeah, I got a little exasperated with him at one point. I said, Frank, it's one man, one book. And it's the only time I ever called him Frank. You know. But but other members of his family cooperated and helped me, cousins, nephews, nieces, sister-in-law, et cetera. A lot of them were very helpful because they were upset that he didn't tell the truth about his parents and his relatives in the book, and he fabricated a lot of stories and made them look poorer than they really were, for example. And his parents were fascinating characters. I'm always fascinated by immigrant stories, and so his mm-hmm. parents were great people. I mean, flawed people, but great people. But so, you know, I got a lot of help from the family, not from his surviving three children. Tom and Frank Jr. talked to me, but in a rather guarded way, and his daughter wouldn't talk to me, wouldn't give me an interview. But at some point, I get the sense that Capra was at odds with Random House over this book, and Jeanine Basinger...
His book? Capra's book?
With my book. I mean, my
biography. Oh, with your book.
You know, because I was exposing his life, and she had... when she got the rights to the Capra papers, Frank Capra and his wife, Lou, signed over not only physical ownership of the papers, but also the copyright to the material, which is extremely important. In other words, Wesleyan owns the copyright. They can publish, or, you know, unpublished letters or diaries or scripts or whatever. There's a lot of that in the papers. Mm-hmm. And that became a big issue because they promised me, yeah, we'll give you permission. And then they started hedging and making all these conditions, and then they wanted to see parts of the manuscript. And I believe at some point Knopf gave them my manuscript, which they admitted at one point they did that. Then they tried to claim they didn't do that, and that's very unethical. And you know, I had a great legal case against them. Part of me wanted to sue them, and my lawyer kept saying, "No, we won't sue them. We'll." He told me actually when he retired, he said, "I've been a lawyer for 49 years, and I've never filed a lawsuit." And I was kind of surprised.
Oh yeah.
He believed in negotiation. Maury Mealy, he was a terrific negotiator.
I guess in the big scheme of things, negotiating turns out more successful than lawsuits.
Yeah. There's a great quote from Voltaire who said, "I've been ruined twice in my life, once when I lost a lawsuit and once when I won a lawsuit."
I love that. I love that quote. That's great.
It's a great quote. Part of it is it's very expensive to sue people, especially in another state. And I would have won, but it would have, I mean, this whole thing was ruinous for me financially.
I know.
Anyway, but to get a lawyer to handle it, I mean, I was paying him, but, you know, if he had filed a lawsuit, it would have been much more expensive, and we were trying to avoid that. But Knopf was over a barrel, and they knew it, but they were hoping I would go away and fold my tent and just give up. And at one point, I asked a friend who was a fellow Random House author to intervene with Sonny Mehta, who's still the head of Random House, and I had never talked to him, and he doesn't answer phone calls and things, but Mehta sent back the word, forget about the Capra book, just do your John Ford biography, which along the way, excuse me, to make money and because I wanted to do a biography of John Ford, which I'd been planning for years, I made a deal with Knopf to do that. So they were paying me money for it, but saying use that money to finish Capra, which, you know, legally complicated their position even more because I couldn't finish the Ford book because they kept stalling me on the Capra book, and I was trying to do both books at once. I finally extricated both books from them and took them both to, I took the Capra book to Simon Schuster and took the Ford book to St. Martin's Press, but, you know, I think the Capra's... Jeanine Basinger was starting to claim they didn't have the copyright to the papers, which is a Kafkaesque maneuver, and that I had to apply to the Capras for permission, which was absurd and impossible because the children were opposed to the book, I was told. Frank Jr. especially, I guess. And so Knopf started Knopf would always apologize and go along with all these maneuvers and lies that she was telling. They weren't on my side at all. And I had an agent even who was not on my side. It turned out he was colluding with them too because he was I had an agent, Mike Hamelberg, who was, at first I thought he was a good guy and he sold
your
the book
lawyer.
To Knopf. Well, he was the agent. Maury Mealy was my lawyer, who was a very honest man. But Mike was behind the scenes kind of trying to sabotage my book because he was trying to curry favor with Knopf, just like Jeanine Basinger was currying favor with Knopf to get to be a writer with them. And he wanted to, you know, as a kind of small-time agent, he wanted to have in with Knopf, you know. Mm-hmm. So I fired him at one point when I figured this out and I fired him. And I went without an agent and it just had a lawyer, which is better anyway. So this became, as you say, very complex, and I kept meticulous notes, and I would write them memos after a phone conversation and things. I would drive them crazy by writing a long memo documenting all their lies and misstatements and prevarications and things, and painted them into a corner. And it's a long story, but eventually I managed to get free of them, but it took a tremendous effort, and I don't think they expected that I would keep holding on, because as my lawyer said at one point, it's terrible, they're trying to starve you into submission, you know.
Right.
I had a wife and I had a small baby, and we were struggling to survive, you know.
Yeah, there was a cold war going on between you and Random House, essentially, but you prevailed. Okay, so again, your book is called Frankly Unmasking Frank Capra. And you self-published this book. Now, was that a decision, in a sense, like ethically made, as you would write an unauthorized biography? You didn't want to compromise yourself. Did you consciously decide to self-publish from the get-go? Or did you actually think of pitching this to Random House? No, I'm kidding, of course. But did you? But maybe there would be a publisher that might be willing to take on such a controversial book.
I've been self-publishing books several times in the last few years. I still publish with regular publishers. For example, my book, How Did Lubitsch Do It, came out with Columbia University Press last year.
Yes, we did a conversation around that book.
Right, and that was fun, and I was glad to. I wanted a regular publisher because, you know, the one advantage with a regular publisher, among other, you know, I mean, they're good people professionally, but they can get the book reviewed and more attention for it.
Well, of course.
Self-published books, you have to do it all yourself, and it's kind of...
And hire a publicist to potentially, you know.
Yeah, or I have a lot of media contacts, and I use those. And
so you were your own publicist as well?
Yeah, people write to, you know, want to write about the book or interview me, and a lot of book publicity is done with podcasts and with internet things. And I published the first self-published book I did, actually my first one in 1968, was called Persistence of Vision, a collection of film criticism when I was with the University of Wisconsin Film Society. And we did our own collection of articles and we published it ourselves. But I found at the time, I naively thought I could take it around to bookstores and they'd stock it, and they all kind of looked at me like I was crazy. It just didn't happen back then. You know, there was a stigma against self-publishing. They called them vanity books, you know. And but the great thing that happened in recent years was Amazon will stock your book, sell your book. And there are these companies called fulfillment houses, which you send them a book, you have it set in type, you have it set, designed, hire a professional designer.
Right.
And she puts it into the form, PDF form, and they print it on demand and sell it. Amazon collects the money. You can buy it directly from the company, which is called Vervante, but usually people buy it through Amazon. So anybody in the world can get it from Amazon. And then Amazon takes a cut, which is fair. And then the print-on-demand company prints it and sends it to the buyer in a few days, and they take a slice. And then you negotiate what the price is so you can make a profit without making the book too expensive. And I find that very congenial because you have complete freedom. And I've done several books in the last few years that are very personal projects, which I've been wanting to do my whole life. And they're not necessarily the kinds of books that regular publishers would do. I did one called Into the Nightmare, My Search for the Killers of President John F. Kennedy and Officer J.D. Tippit.
And those are books like that automatically are, well, there's an enormous community around the Kennedy assassination subject, right? So there's that, that's that.
Well, there are a lot of books published on that subject, but not by major publishers. The major publishers like Random House is one of the worst offenders. They publish supporting the Warren Commission, you know?
Right. I'm defending self-publishing on such a subject because there is a large community around people. There will be a sort of a default number of people that will buy your book, especially because it's from Joe McBride, based on a subject of that particular subject. Whereas, if you were writing about some other subject, you know, there wouldn't necessarily be quite the enthusiastic community.
Yeah, there's a niche market of people who want to read books, and many books keep coming out on the assassination, and a lot of them are self-published, or there are a few small publishers who will publish books on the subject that are, the position that the government was lying to us, but you can't expect a major publisher to publish a book like that. So I want this book to be completely free and
right. And in fact, a major publisher might give this signal or the sense that you must have compromised as an author to get published by a major author, publisher. Excuse me.
Well, there's some cases.
It's almost ironic that if you're published by a major publishing company, how could you write a book about the assassination conspiracy theory freely?
Well, to give an example, there's a terrific historian, Peter Dale Scott, who wrote an excellent book on the Kennedy assassination. It was published by University of California Press, which is an important academic publisher, and I've been published by them. But he admitted that they made him cut out or tone down certain aspects of what he was trying to say. It's still a very strong, gutsy book, but he did have to sanitize it to some extent. Unfortunately, I don't know exactly what they did, but I didn't want that to happen. And so,
And if people get a whiff of that, if enthusiastic readers of that subject get wind of that, that's what leads to a suspicion of major publishers publishing books on that subject. That they can, in a way, they could end up actually like making people that are want to read about the conspiracy of the Kennedy assassination, it could ward them off, is my point. The major publishers.
You don't want your readers to read compromised material. And I mean, I did offer that book to Robert Gottlieb while I was doing Capra book. I was trying to come up with other projects to, bring in money. And also that was a pet project I'd been working on since 82. And he turned it down. He said he was uncomfortable with it, predictably. So that book has done very well. It keeps selling every day. We get orders from around the world, and it's a good way to do a book. And then I published a memoir called The Broken Places with Vervante.
Was that about your own personal struggles?
Yeah, my own story of my troubled youth, which I think is a good story. And that was published.
I have
published
to read that one.
And that's a book that I've been working on for a long time. And then I did a collection of my articles. I've done many short articles long, short articles about film. So it's called Two Cheers for Hollywood, Joseph McBride on Movies. And I did that so I've done these four self-published books. But the Capra book, I didn't feel that any regular publisher would want to go near it because it attacks Random House and an icon of publishing, Robert Gottlieb, and it's a club. They all kind of protect each other to some extent, and even if they had wanted to publish it, it would have been maybe a battle to sanitize the book or leave out certain things. And I just wanted to be completely independent and do it my way, and so I was very happy to do that. And it is a way of getting the book out there and uncompromised, but it hasn't been reviewed a lot by mainstream publications, but it's had some really excellent reviews, and Amazon readers love the book, etc. And so it's you may not have a bestseller. There have been some cases though. There are actually more self-published books in America now than there are books from regular publishers. And the actor Jack Klugman, a few years ago, he could have sold his autobiography to anybody, and he had throat cancer, which was, kind of a moving part of his story. He continued acting with throat cancer. And so he wrote a memoir, and he decided to self-publish it, and he sold 125,000 copies. And you know, you get your money right away, too. You don't have to wait for years. And sometimes publishers cheat you on royalties. I've had that happen, too. Mm-hmm. So it proves that if there's a market for it, you can self-publish and do very well with it. And
well, but Jack Klugman also had like 60 years of professional
television
and movies and plays. So you have a following. And Joseph McBride has a following. You know, I mean, you get my point.
Yeah, he was a star.
If I self-published, right, and you're a well-known commodity as well. But you know, I mean, if I self-published a book, I mean, I'm not going to get, I need a publisher. You may, if you figure out the equation just right, you could probably figure out how to, you know, profit off of this idea. And Jack Klugman, obviously, expediency was probably part of what motivated him, but he obviously has a following. So, you know, I can see why that would work. You know, Louis C.K., before the controversies of the last couple of years, he was sort of self-publishing in the sense that he would just, he had such an enormous following that he could just put his series right on his website with a paywall. And then he, you know, or put a comedy special right on his website with a paywall. And keep the price pretty low because there's no middleman. There's no company that he has to go through. And, you know.
Well, I tell authors this, that this is a good way to go. And, you know, Klugman or somebody of that magnitude could have sold it with a good advance. A lot of authors want to get a big advance because sometimes you never get much royalties. But, you know, I'm not the kind of author who gets a huge advance, although I actually got a very good advance for both the Ford and Capra books. But, I write in my Frankly book that it's commercially unviable for me to write biographies because I wind up spending more money than I than I get as an advance because I do more work than is required.
Right,
and I don't cut any corners, and so I wind up losing money on these big biographies, and I can't really afford to do that.
Is that specifically film biographies you're talking about, or are you talking about biographies in general?
Yeah, well, certainly a lot of biographies are very popular, and it depends on the subject. But I think that there's a real decline in the interest in serious books on film. For example, if you go to bookstores like Barnes & Noble, which themselves are becoming fewer and fewer, they used to have a big film section. Now they have a tiny film section, and this is becoming more and more common. So it's hard to get books on film published. And what I found was people are not terribly interested in reading about the lives of movie directors. It's a small number of people like you and me and hardcore film buffs that are interested in the lives of Frank Capra, Michael Curtiz, or even Steven Spielberg. When I wrote my book on him, I didn't.
Wait, you wrote a book on Michael Curtiz?
No. I'm saying that there is.
I'm kidding.
There is a biography, good biography on him. University Press of Kentucky published that, and I published a book on Orson Welles with them. And university presses are good, but they get the books reviewed, but they don't usually sell a lot. But they're good publishers, but. The point I was going to make was my Spielberg biography. I didn't write it because I thought I'd make a lot of money, but I wrote it because I felt that he was a neglected figure who had an amazing life. But I was surprised it didn't sell very well. And what I finally concluded, and this is a little flippant, but it's basically true, is that the people who like his movies don't read books, and the people who read books don't like his movies, you know. But the Capra book didn't sell terribly well, and it has not been published in foreign languages because, ironically, Capra is seen as such an American director. He's not terribly popular in Europe and Asia. Like my Spielberg book, I just made a deal in China. It's being published again in China. It was before, too. But
I guess you're not charging too large a tariff on.
Well, I'm getting a decent advance, but sometimes it's hard to get royalties out of China. You know, they've been known to. But I'm told by my agent over there that they will pay royalties, so let's hope. But, you know, Capra, it would be nice if it were published in French or German or whatever, as some film books are. Like my Ford book was published in France and Spain, for example.
And that was even longer.
That was a huge book. Yeah, in France, it's over 1,000 pages.
Oh.
It won an award as the best foreign film book from the French critics. So that's another thing they say about foreign editions, is if a real long book is hard to sell in a foreign language, because first of all, translating it is more expensive and costs more to print. But Capra is just so American, which is part of the great irony. He was a tremendously American figure, even though he was an Italian from Sicily, and he really loved America, and he was betrayed by America, and then he in turn betrayed his colleages, and felt guilty about it, and he more or less blacklisted himself. He wasn't ever officially blacklisted. As I say, there wasn't a list you could look at, but he was known to be at least gray-listed, and he left Hollywood in 51 in a kind of a rush when they were starting to... The House Committee was starting a new round of Hollywood hearings, and Capra panicked and moved to his ranch in Southern California, became a rancher for a few years, and eventually made a fitful attempt at a comeback and made some bad films. And then he, but it was, the last part of his life is very sad because, I mean, the last part of his career, because he had all these projects that he wanted to do that kept getting turned down, and I read them all. It was a depressing job, and most of them were pretty bad. He said literally he would not work with any liberal writers anymore, and if you say that, you're not going to work with most of the good writers in Hollywood. And he wanted to write films himself, which was a problem because he wasn't a terribly good screenwriter, and it caused friction with his writers. And he also kind of found God at that time. He, because of his political crisis, he went back to the Catholic Church and became this militant Catholic anti-communist, and so he started trying to make a lot of religious type films, and there were some made in the 50s, you know, Bible films and things, but the studios seemed embarrassed by a lot of the projects he brought to them, and they kept turning them down, and the one I wish he had made was The Life of St. Paul, starring Frank Sinatra. That sounds like it might have been fun, actually. But he had all kinds of strange projects, and other kinds of projects too, and it was just really bitter, and he was seen as a has-been, and he also struck people as very insecure and defensive and inarticulate, and he was weakened by his moral failure. I think he was a big enough man that he was a real tragic character. The tragedy, as Aristotle says, consists in a person of talent or promise who fails and then realizes his failings, you know, before he dies or is destroyed, like Macbeth, for example. And Capra was a big enough man that he realized he had done something terrible, and he also blamed the country, so he exiled himself. But he lost his ability to make films, you know, he lost his confidence, and he lost his, he told me he couldn't make decisions anymore, which I thought was very telling, because decisions were what caused him his problems. He made a decision to inform on people, and you know that led to all kinds of consequences. So he retired in the 60s. He finally got fed up, and he was really despondent, and he had temptations towards suicide, etc. And then he thought of writing books, and he wrote a couple of manuscripts. One was a novel that was just published recently, which is quite a poor novel, actually, unfortunately. And another was a kind of fantasy autobiography that actually in some ways is a little more honest than the name above the title. And his friends told him, don't publish this because this will destroy your image. And so then they persuaded him to write The Name Above the Title, which rewrote his life as a Frank Capra movie, you know, little guy beats the system. Yeah. And then I found out he had a ghostwriter in that because he couldn't really finish it. So he went to a man named Eugene Vail, who I interviewed, a professional writer who helped him polish this up. So it's a book that is pretty well written, but, you know, there are parts of it that are better written than others, which is a tip-off usually that, you know, there was a ghostwriter. But the book was a big bestseller and made Capra a star again, and he went to colleges and became a hero of the youth. And it was very ironic because he said, you know, I'm being honored for somebody who I'm not, in a sense, you know. And it's hard. I think it's very hard if you get praise and love for being what you aren't.
Because I agree. And then and not being rewarded for what you are. Yeah,
I think we would all like to be loved for who we are.
Right. You can't.
But he couldn't right. have met who he was. You know?
Right. Yeah. No. Ultimately, it's toxic. It's a toxic thing. I read your book. I did not read yet Frank Capra, The Catastrophe of Success, which is the book we've been also referring to that you wrote back in, or was published in 1992 by Simon Schuster, ultimately. But I'm sort of going backwards around it. I ordered Capra's book, his fiction novel.
Oh, yeah.
I'm kind of going about it a little bit backwards, but I plan to read both of those books. It's just really glad to have had the opportunity to, in a way, to start with the truth. You know, yeah. I think it liberates everybody. You know, ultimately, it's a jagged pill, but it sets you free. You know, ultimately, it sets you free. You know, I have a feeling that's what Ilya Kazan encountered. You know, he decided to, to set himself free. You know, he wrote the truth ultimately.
His book is an interesting contrast to Capra's. His autobiography, ironically edited by Robert Gottlieb, and his papers are at Wesleyan.
Yeah, that's right.
But it seemed like, I've not read his papers, and I've seen his films, but it seemed like an honest autobiography, very scathing. I don't think anybody could have done a bigger job on Kazan than Kazan did on himself. But he's such an
incredible writer. It turns out.
Yeah, I mean, it's a gripping book, but it confronts the truth about, okay, here's what I did, I informed, this is why I did it, and it's self-justifying, but it's his version.
He doesn't come out of it with more, I think that people have a deeper understanding, but that doesn't mean he gained any fans or, you know, like, I think that there are those that forgave and those who didn't, and, you know, but... Yeah. He stuck his neck out, at least, you could say that much.
Well, I think he's an interesting contrast to Capra because, as you say, he went public. Mm-hmm. He not only testified in public, but he took out a big ad in the New York Times, a very pugnacious ad about why he was informing, which really outraged people. And I looked up, I went to Washington, and I read his secret testimony before HUAC, and he was trying to avoid informing, but then he did inform to save his own skin. And he took the heat, and he always admitted that he felt ambivalent about it. He felt there was something shameful about it, but he tried to defend his position, which is complicated. But Capra took the opposite path, which was to hide what he was doing and secretly inform and lie. And I think, you know, it's an interesting moral question. Who is the better person, the one who does it openly and takes the heat, or the person who does it clandestinely? And I think in a psychological sense, it probably was better for Kazan to be open about it. At least you're not carrying around this horrible secret like Capra was, and you can sort of be yourself. I think we all want to be ourselves, whether we get heat from people or not. But Capra was this hypocrite, and he was getting honored by people, and he was sort of disgusted. I found an extraordinary letter he wrote about his fans. He was heaping abuse on his fans for being stupid, basically, for... Wow. Liking him and not really.
So many layers to his...
Yeah, I mean, what a shocking kind of letter. And then he wrote another letter to a guy who wrote him about his book, and he said, I don't owe anything to anybody. I'm just a tough SOB who's been fighting my whole life, and I don't really care about the public. I don't owe them anything. And, you know, I mean, he was very pugnacious toward his fans. This was somebody who admired him, and he was kind of putting him down for liking him. And that's an unhappy position to be in. And so I think Capra was a quite unhappy man. So the first half of his life is a tremendous record of success. And the second half, you know, he lived 91 years. The last 45 years were downhill and depressing. And yet he had this sort of ironic apotheosis toward the end where he not only was honored at schools and things, but he was given the AFI award and other awards, and he was treated like a hero. And he felt ambivalent toward that because he knew that he was, owed a lot to his writers. This was part of his dilemma. When you read Catastrophe of Success, you'll see that's a big theme in the book, is that a lot of what we consider Capra-esque themes are the product of Robert Riskin and Joe Swerling and Sidney Buckman and people like that. Mm-hmm. And one of one of Riskin's friends, Philip Dunn, the screenwriter, said they should really call it Riskin-esque. Mm. And Capra knew that before Riskin came along, he said he was looking for something to say. He was a journeyman director who was a good director in different genres, but he didn't have a strong vision or theme. And Ingmar Bergman said what makes a great director is having a vision. Mm. And Capra had a vision, but it was Robert Riskin's vision pretty much. And he knew that, and he was very angry, though, when people would point that out, you know. And when I tried to talk to him about Riskin, he would get really upset. And he once claimed to me Riskin was a lousy writer, which is ridiculous, of course. But he was very inflamed by the whole subject of authorship. And the title of his book is a direct reference to authorship, the name above the title. In other words, I got my name above the title. And the irony there is he didn't get his name above the title until the 24th of the 25 films that he directed for Columbia. So for the first 23, he did not get his name above the title. And when he was a part of the problem he had with Riskin when they started a production company to make films independently, he called it Frank Capra Productions, and Riskin was offended. He wanted it to be called something like Capra Riskin Productions, but Capra's ego would not allow him to do that. And so he alienated people like that who were really helping him. And, you know, that's part of the secret of the film industry. The good directors like Howard Hawks told me, I said to him, how come you didn't put your name on the script as a writer, even though you contributed to a lot of your films? He said, because if I did, I couldn't get such good writers to work with me. And that's very smart, you know.
Right, sure.
And he had enough self-confidence. He didn't...
Yeah, really have less to get tortured. Writing credit. Less tortured, less ambivalent, right?
Yeah, and he would be generous to
Capra
talk
was
about.
Obviously a severely conflicted person, so...
Yeah, and Hawks would be generous toward his writers. Capra would not, but conflicted people make for great biographies. And
yes, right.
Capra's, I mean, what sustained me for the 7 years of suffering in this book was that the craft of writing the book was stimulating, and the subject matter was so fascinating that I was just really, you know, writing the book actually was the easy part. The hard part was getting it published. And so then I wrote this book, frankly, Unmasking Frank Capra, which I've been carrying around my whole, you know, 20-some years. And it actually, I worried a little about, gee, I'm getting into this again. Will I be really... traumatized again by reliving this, but actually I wasn't. I felt kind
That's
of
good.
Pleased. I found that it was liberating to write this book because I got it off my chest, and I enjoyed telling what is a good story. And I think people who are interested in writing and biographies or in the lives of famous people, like how hard it is to get the truth about a famous person published. And that's, you mentioned Caro's collection of articles, and he writes about that, how hard it was to get the truth about Robert Moses and Lyndon Johnson, who were great American figures who people thought they knew, but they really didn't, you know. And I think that's a fascinating subject. And that's part of what the whole biographical enterprise is about. And I think people who like biographies will find my book and Caro's book interesting in that regard.
Well, then that leads to the last question that I have for you is if you're, as you described it earlier, finding the pursuit of writing film director biographies a losing battle, what are you going to write about?
Well, I've gone back to writing critical studies, which is how I started. When I was a young guy in college at the University of Wisconsin, I was writing a book on Orson Welles, who is one of my favorite directors. And he put me, while I was just about done with that book, he put me into The Other Side of the Wind, the film that came out finally last year. I play a young film critic who's following John Huston around writing a book about him. So I wrote this critical study of Wells, and then I did a critical study of John Ford with Mike Wilmington, and I wrote those in Madison before I came to Hollywood. And even though I had 18 years as a screenwriter and some successes and a lot of frustrations, but I feel I couldn't have written the Capra book and the other biographies without that experience in the trenches. You know, it really taught me here's how films are really made, this is how the system works, and a much more realistic view than I had when I started. But I've gone back to the Lubitsch book as a critical study because, I mean, there is a biography of him, and his life was not terribly exciting other than filmmaking. He was a workaholic who didn't have, you know, John Ford had a very adventurous life in many ways, and Capra's life was very tortured and complex, and Spielberg's life is fascinating for a lot of reasons, and they make good biographies, but the Lubitsch book, I really felt his films needed to be explored and understood and brought to people's attention. So I had, I mean, it's a long book, it's 500 pages long, so I wove in there some biographical things and discoveries I'd made, and old interviews I found with him that people hadn't read for decades and things. And so now I'm doing one on Billy Wilder, who's another director who I love, doing a critical study of him. And there again, there are some biographies of him, and there's some good ones, both in English and German. And
well, I know I had one biographer on the show.
Which one?
Ed Seekoff.
Oh, yeah. His book is excellent. Yeah.
I thought he did a fabulous job. He did the podcast, then at the very end, he, you know, described then ultimately meeting Billy and his wife and, you know, in Hollywood and having dinner or and what that experience was like for him. It's a fascinating story.
Yeah, I guess it happened late in the process. Wilder was kind of keeping him at arm's length, and then he finally agreed to meet him. But, no, Ed did a great job of pulling together, you know, all the stories and facts about this very complicated life that he had. And there are a couple of books in German that are not as good, but interesting biographies in one way or the other. And there are some fairly good critical studies of Wilder too, but I felt there was not one that, you know, satisfied me anyway. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to bring together, I've been writing about him for 50 some years, and I have a lot of thoughts about him that are orthodox or unorthodox. I just did the audio commentary on a film that just came out today, A Foreign Affair, which is a wonderful film.
I love that movie.
Yeah, I'm glad you like it. Yeah, that's not a very well-known
film. And it's really outrageous.
Yeah, there's some
really outrageous moments in that film. Shocking moments. You know, I know, because as I was reading Ed's book, I was just watching pretty much everything. In many cases rewatching, of course, because which was a nice opportunity to revisit a lot of the films. But I was surprised by how many I hadn't seen.
Yeah, a lot of his films, I mean, some are very well known, but there are some wonderful films that are more obscure. And Foreign Affair, for whatever reason, I go into why it kind of got overlooked. It was controversial in its time, and I think Paramount kind of dumped it. They didn't, you know, the government was against it and various things. But who else would make a romantic comedy set in the ruins of post-war Berlin, you know? And it starts with some very graphic shots of, you know, this totally devastated city. And it's about Jean Arthur, my favorite actress, who Capra helped make into a big star. Yours too. Good.
I love Jean Arthur. And just barely second to Myrna Loy.
Ah, yeah. She's great. And in Bonnie and Clyde, you remember C.W. Moss, their driver, said, Myrna Loy, she's my favorite picture star. Michael J. Pollan.
But, yeah, I love him too.
yeah. Jean Arthur in this Foreign Affair, she's a congresswoman, a very right-wing, kind of like Sarah Palin, prudish congresswoman who's investigating GI misconduct with German women, which is a funny subject and just a fact of life back then. But she gets romanced and seduced in the course of the film. That's a theme that he loved, was the seduction of a prudish person and changing from a cold person to an emotional person. It's a wonderful movie, and Marlene Dietrich is great in it.
Yeah, she is great, but there's a scene where John Lund, he takes her back to her place, isn't it? And he, like, their whole, like, seduction involves him pretending to choke her or something.
It's all sadomasochistic stuff, and she's a former Nazi. She's a Nazi.
Right. Yeah, it's really, really something, considering Billy Wilder's background. Yeah,
it's amazing, because she was so anti-Nazi and heroic supporter of the Allied cause, and he had trouble talking her into doing it. It's astonishing that she did that, but she does a wonderful job, and she plays...
Oh, right. Was she pretty leftist progressive in that way?
Well, she was big. She entertained the troops for years. Wilder said she spent more time at the front than Eisenhower, which was a joke, but it may be true, actually. Being a German, she was appalled by the Nazis, and she turned against her own country. And later, a lot of Germans thought she was a traitor and they didn't like her very much, but she was very pro-American. And she got the Medal of Freedom from President Truman right around the time she did Foreign Affair. So for her to play a Nazi is quite a daring thing to do, and she plays it very well. Yeah. But she's a very morally complex figure, as Wilder's people right. always are. She's not totally unsympathetic. She has a certain... There's a certain sympathy you have because she's a survivor, you know, despite it all.
In your work, have you also explored the relationship between Billy and Charles Brackett?
Oh, yeah. I've been studying Brackett a lot. He had two main collaborators, Charles Brackett and then later I.A.L. Diamond, and I've been studying both their contributions. And I do that a lot in my biographies. You know, with Capra, I studied his writers, as I've been mentioning, how important his work with his writers was. And the same with Wilder, who always had a collaborator. He never had a script that was a sole screenplay. He always had people working with him. That's, he liked collaborating. And so Brackett brought a lot to him, and then they had a falling out, and then he had a more harmonious relationship.
But Brackett's more interesting to me because I.L. Diamond, that, you know, they just would write, their stuff was more straightforward, more broader, more popular, had much more just broad popular appeal, whereas his relationship with Brackett was obviously a little bit more complicated. And I wonder how much Brackett had to do with A Foreign Affair, because, you know,
well,
making a Nazi sympathetic was...
I go into all that. It gets complex because Brackett was a Republican, very different from Wilder, who's a Democrat.
Oh, yeah. Right.
And Jean Arthur was a leftist. Right? She plays a Republican in the film. And I think actually her character owes a lot to Brackett. It's kind of Wilder's way of making fun of Brackett in some ways. But Brackett participated. But he was appalled by certain aspects of Foreign Affair, like when Dietrich is brushing her teeth and she spits a mouthload of foamy
toothpaste
in the face of John Lund. And Brackett thought this was horrifying and disgusting, and he said it makes her look like a whore. And Wilder says that a woman in love is always a whore. And Brackett said, "Billy, you're a pervert," you know. And then he said, "Well, a man in love is always a pervert," you know. So they had certain clashes of personality, which in a way worked toward their benefit. They made some terrific films, and Sunset Boulevard is a great script. And I think with Diamond, he was a funnier writer in some ways, but. They went off into a realm of very moving romantic films toward the end of their time together that were not well received, but I love them. The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes and Avanti and Fedora, those are very moving films that were pretty much rejected by the public, so I'm dealing with that.
I understand why Fedora was, but...
Fedora had problems, but it was moving in many ways as a reflection on the changing film industry.
Right.
And stardom. But I think Avanti is one of his best films, and Sherlock Holmes is a wonderful film.
Yeah, I liked Avanti a lot, actually. What was the other one with Dean Martin?
Oh, I love Kiss Me Stupid.
That was one that it was put on my radar for the first time. I don't know how I ever missed that film.
How did you like that?
I really enjoyed it. It just felt like the least Billy Wilder film, for some reason. I don't know why.
Really?
Yeah,
the
I don't
least
know.
Billy
it was, I don't know. It just seems like out of step with so much of what he was doing at the time, but I still enjoyed it. I thought it was really entertaining. The only film, and by the way, to show and to illustrate just how popular Billy Wilder is, you can get almost every single film of his, you know, online, easily get, they're all available. The only thing I had a little bit of difficulty was that Bing Crosby film, that early Bing Crosby. So I had to order that on DVD, and I still haven't watched it.
You can get that. It's on DVD with another Bing Crosby film.
Yeah, right, yeah. But, there were two films on the DVD, but it was obviously maybe a testament to the fact that it wasn't really...
Yeah, it's,
it was one,
it's
of his
one of
weakest,
his strangest films. But actually, I'd say the least characteristic film that Wilder directed is The Spirit of St. Louis, his film on Charles Lindbergh, which seems very anomalous for him, although it has some virtues, but it's kind of inert dramatically. But Kiss Me Stupid, when you see my book, I think that's one of his best films, and it's very much in the line of his exploration of sexual repression and sexual liberation and sexual hypocrisy, and sort of it's an examination of American hypocrisy and Puritanism and what we call the ugly American character. Gene Arthur exemplifies that in Foreign Affair, and Ray Walston is like that in in Kiss Me Stupid, but he turns into a mensch because of his romance with the prostitute. That film really outraged people at the time, although, you know, it was just ahead of the sexual revolution in films, and if it had come out two or three years later, it wouldn't have been such a scandal, but it set back their career a lot, but it made Wilder more defiantly romantic. I said to him, I thought that was a very romantic film, actually. He said, yeah, I thought it was too. He said, you know, I didn't understand why they were so upset.
Yeah, and putting Dean Martin in, I think, was a wise choice because I don't think the American public could resist Dean Martin. If Dean Martin, if they put it in some other actor, the American public might have rejected the film because of what you're just talking about.
That's a good point.
If Dean Martin kind of gave the film the legitimacy or whatever. Because he was so beloved, you know.
Well, he's so funny and
good,
but I mean, he's a repellent kind of character, but you kind of like him because he's such a complete scoundrel too, you know. They were thinking of Frank Sinatra for that part. He might have been good too, but Martin is funnier than Sinatra, of course, you know.
Definitely. Yeah. This is a good teaser talking a little bit about Billy Wilder, setting us up for our next conversation.
Yeah.
When I read your Billy Wilder book, you're so prolific. It's just beyond understanding. But thank you for this. The name of the book, again, is Frankly, Unmasking Frank Capra. It is a startling story about writing this biography that you did 30 years ago. All the challenges of that experience and much more. It's a very personal book. I was impressed with that.
Well, thank you for having me and talking about this very personal project, as you say, and really delving deeply into all the questions about biography the book raises. I appreciate you doing that, and I'm really glad we had this talk. This is always fun talking to you.
Yeah, me too. I always enjoy it. And one of these days, we're going to have to meet up. I might have to come out to L.A., but you're in Northern California, right?
Yeah, I'm in Berkeley, California.
You're in Berkeley.
Love to meet you.
Yeah, no, it's been many, many years since I've been to Berkeley, decades. So I have to find a reason to come out.
Good, good. Yeah, come out and we'll run around the campus. And Berkeley's a very nice place. It reminds
it's
me
beautiful.
Of Madison, where I used to live. And
I love that town too. Yeah,
Thornton Wilder.
The city on the lakes or the town on what is it called?
The three lakes there, four lakes mm-hmm. actually. Thornton Wilder wrote Our Town, his wonderful play about a small town, and he was from Madison. And he based it partly on Madison, but I read that his family moved to Berkeley when he was 10, so it's based on Madison and Berkeley. And so I thought, hey, that's why I like Berkeley.
The same connection.
You know?
And you're lucky because you didn't end up getting married to Ruth Gordon. So
right. So I have a nice teaching position at San Francisco State where I get to show Billy Wilder films and Frank Capra films. I'm going to mm-hmm. talk about Capra there and show more Wilder films and teach a course this fall on Orson Welles. And, you know, it's always fun exposing the students to great films.
I wish I could sit in on those classes. That would be great.
Well, be my guest if you come out here. It'd be great
to
see you.
I will.
Okay.
I will. All right. Thank you, Joe.
Thanks a lot. Talk to you later. Bye.
Everybody, we have another episode actually with Joseph McBride talking about John Ford. We'll post that soon. It's actually already available, to be honest with you. It's already on the Filmwax Radio YouTube channel. You can go there and listen to it there as well, but I'll put it on the podcast. It should be on the podcast. And we're going to bring McBride back again. We'll talk about Billy Wilder. As you heard, he's working on something regarding Billy Wilder. So there's going to be lots more opportunities to bring Joe McBride back on the podcast. Stay tuned for the next episode of the show. We have a very special episode. We have the filmmakers behind a new documentary about the career and life of Linda Ronstadt. We have those filmmakers. And we have the legendary actor, Bruce Dern, who can be currently seen in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and in an upcoming film called science fiction film called Freaks, co-starring Emil Hirsch, who is also in the Tarantino film, it turns out. So anyway, that's all coming up on the next episode of the podcast. And we have Lee Grant coming up. Lee Grant, who it's a dream episode. I have to tell you, one of my best. I'm not saying that, it is true. We have Morgan Spurlock coming up on the show and much more. So please continue to tune in to FilmWax Radio. Thank you very much, everybody. Take care of yourselves and the ones you love. Broken lines, broken strings.